I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. You know, on any given news day, there are countless candidates for the top story. And these top stories, they come and go kind of like horses on a carousel, you know? Some news stories rarely make the front page. These other stories are abiding, persistent, sometimes immensely important stories. They just never make the front page. And one of these massive stories is the story of how water is situated on our planet. We could be talking about Greenland or Antarctica or Polynesia. We could be talking about the Black Sea, the Dead Sea, the Red Sea. Water everywhere and nowhere. Here today, gone tomorrow, sometimes frozen, sometimes vapor. If water were a person, I think water should be Time Magazine's Person of the Year. And then the next year and the year after that, in perpetuity, because water is foundational. And our water crises seem to be perpetual. We're about to meet somebody who has taken a deep interest in water that's becoming quite shallow, a body of water becoming quite shallow. When I was a boy, I was growing up in San Diego area, I frequently heard about the Salton Sea, but I never got a chance to visit the place. And I assumed way too much about the Salton Sea. I pretty much equated it with a body of water like the Dead Sea in the Middle East or the Great Salt Lake in the Intermountain West here in the United States, a landlocked body of water, salty, of course. It accumulates this salinity because it's dead. Well, it's a dead end for water, except for the evaporation, the going up into the air, no rivers coming out. Little did I know back then that the Salton Sea is not an ancient body of water. It's very, very young in geologic time. Its history is very strange, and its future is very troubled. It's really an environmental disaster at this point. Well, I want to introduce you to Greg Bessenian. Greg Bessenian has made a livelihood for himself in the world of film. He is founder and executive producer of commercial production and post-house Eris, and he has spent about 5 years investigating, filming, and documenting this unfolding environmental story of the Salton Sea. He has credits, by the way, that include working on television shows, The King of Queens, as well as working as a writer on the CSI franchise. You may have heard of those things. Well, he has produced, directed, I should say now, a documentary titled Miracle in the Desert, The Rise and Fall of the Salton Sea, a new documentary. He's on the line with us. Greg Bessenian, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks for having me. Really, really appreciate it.
Now, you're a native Southern Californian yourself, I have heard.
Yes, so I was born and raised in Laguna Beach, so not too far from San Diego, actually.
And was that frontal range, the coastal range of California, was that a barrier for you, or did you frequently pop over to the other side into the desert in places like the Salton Sea?
So actually, much like you, I never went to the Salton Sea. I hadn't even heard of it, honestly, till I was probably in my mid-20s, I want to say. So I knew about Palm Springs. I think as a kid, you hear about that living in Southern California. But the Salton Sea and crossing those mountains, not so much, actually. So I was not familiar with the area until I really started diving into the film.
Now, when I was a kid, when I heard about it from people who went there for the sake of birds. I guess the sea, in spite of its youth, had become quite the stopping point for migratory birds.
Yeah, so California in general, we've lost a lot of our wetlands, and that's another thing that I sort of learned while you know producing the film. We've lost, I think, over 90% of our wetlands, and so what's happened is those birds, they don't have the stopover points when they're migrating that they used to have. So naturally, they're looking for bodies of water as they're flying, and the Salton Sea happened to, you know, be this extraordinarily large and at the time bountiful place for millions of birds to stop over. So it's a very critical ecosystem, and it still is a critical ecosystem for a huge portion of the bird population, which is why the sort of slow decline of the sea has larger ecological implications across the board.
Well, let's take a few steps backwards and just some basics. Exactly where is it? You've mentioned Palm Springs. How big is it? And then we'll get into its history.
Sure. So the Salton Sea is about 150 miles southeast of Los Angeles. So it's kind of the best way to frame it is if you were in between LA and San Diego and you went inland about 100 miles, you would run smack into the Salton Sea. And as far as the size of it, it's about 15 miles wide and about 30 to 32 miles long. So at its current level, it's roughly 330, 340 square miles. In the past, it's been larger. It's been closer to 360 or 370 square miles. So it's extremely large, and it is still currently the largest lake in the state of California. To the north of it, you're going to get Coachella, you're going to get Indian Wells and Palm Springs. So it's about half an hour, 45 minutes from some of those communities. And to the south, you have the Imperial Valley, which is a lot of, it's a huge farming community, and you've got El Centro and Mexicali.
Now let's get into this business of the fact that it's not a natural body of water. This kind of stupefied me when I first learned about that. That's a huge amount of water, and we humans put it there?
Yes. Yeah, so the unique thing about the Salton Sea is, I don't want to give too much away, and we cover this in the film, but effectively what happened was that that area where the Salton Sea is was a desert, right? So up until about 1905, there was nothing there. Historically, there has been overflow of water into that area. So there's been some natural overflow of the Colorado River, which runs down into the Gulf of the Sea of Cortez. In the past, certain occasions, it's filled up with a little bit of water. But prior to this, what you see out there now, there was nothing there. It was just sand, effectively. And there was a push in the early 1900s in Southern California to irrigate some of the land out in that valley. There was a thought that maybe this land could be viable for farming. It could be developed. The only issue was, how do you get water there? So they, short version is, they knew the Colorado River was nearby, and they tapped that Colorado River to bring water down into Southern California. And then there was a huge engineering mistake, effectively. And what happened was, the Colorado River, the whole river diverted into that valley for close to 2 years. And it effectively just filled this entire part of Southern California with water. And it's a staggering amount of water. It's a staggering size. It's really kind of hard to understand from a scope standpoint until you go see it.
I just want to see the faces of the people who realize, whoops. I mean, what do you do at that point? Do you scramble and you say, we're taking too much, we got to get the water back into its real course? Or 2 years went by.
Yeah, so 2 years, and you know, the beginning of the film does a historical overview of this part of the sea, and what you find out is there was a couple engineers that were kind of the head people involved in this whole project. They were engineers, but they were also trying to be landmen and develop it so they could effectively market it and sell some of that property, right? So they, once this happened, it was a huge catastrophe, a huge scale, and they had to involve the Southern Pacific Railroad. They had to call the president at the time. So this is sort of a part of California history that is a little bit overlooked. And it went all the way to the highest level of the government. I mean, there were conversations with President Roosevelt and the head of the Southern Pacific about this flooding that was going on.
Now, the flooding was just the very first domino in a string of events. And this changed the course of history for that region, because all sorts of new speculation, I guess, started to happen. With water there, you could do all kinds of things.
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, anytime there's a lake or lakefront property or anything like that, what you are inevitably going to see is people, A, just wanting to be around that water. So they want to, you know, people want to swim, they want to go fishing, they want to do all that type of stuff. And the sea was naturally sort of full of certain fish because the Colorado River had washed in fish, and they survived and they multiplied. But people kind of tried to develop the area. Even starting in the 20s, there were some people that showed up and built a dance hall and a mess hall, and they would do tours. And somebody tried to, this isn't in the film, but at some point somebody brought flamingos. And actually, flamingos live like 100 years. So up until maybe 10 years ago, there was flamingos left over from the 1910s or the 1920s. Apparently somebody tried to bring in sea lions, I believe. I mean, they tried to bring in all these kind of odd things around 1920. There was a boat, like a river boat, that they tried to bring in, and it sunk. So there was a lot of kind of entrepreneurship going on around the sea, and it didn't work out at first. And then as you got into the 30s and the 40s, a couple things started to happen that really kind of kicked off what would become a frenzy in the 50s and the 60s.
Well, with this all beginning as an accident, as a mistake, then suddenly you have this lake where theretofore there had been no water to speak of. Then you have to at least make some kind of plans for the future. And if the water's there and if people are coming to it, what does the government do? What becomes public policy in terms of making the best out of the situation?
Well, early on, so I, you know, right around the 40s, what happened was, I don't think anybody quite knew. At that time, the way water was being distributed in Southern California, there was, you know, the thought that water coming to the Salton Sea wasn't necessarily going to be an issue because Los Angeles and San Diego County were not quite as big as they are today. So what would happen is the water from the Colorado River would irrigate the farms and fields in the Imperial Valley, and then you'd have runoff water that would go into the sea and it would keep it somewhat stable. So through the 40s, they stocked the Salton Sea with fish. It became a huge fishery. 50s and 60s, there was a sort of a Riviera that developed. And what happened then with the water, to your point, is in the 70s and 80s, as LA and San Diego suddenly expanded very, very quickly, they were already expanding, but they started really developing. They started to understand that the drain on the Colorado River to go to those cities was the pressure on that water source was larger. And different agencies and different interests began to start negotiations or fight for water, essentially, as a piece of territory. The agency that controls all the water in the Imperial Valley is called the Imperial Irrigation District. They have the water right control of all of that water that comes in. And effectively in the 80s, they kind of went about trying to protect their water rights and trying to keep as much water as possible. But that has changed now. And, you know, agreements were signed in the early 2000s that slowly started to give more water to San Diego and Los Angeles, less water into the Imperial Valley. And that has kind of started to cause the slow decline of the sea and the ecological issues that you see today.
We are going to talk about those ecological issues because they are grave. They are serious issues. Time to take a short break here on our show. We'll be right back to continue our conversation with Greg Bassenian. We're talking with him about his documentary, Miracle in the Desert, The Rise and Fall of the Salton Sea. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Greg Bassenian is with us. He's the director of a documentary just new out in September of 2020. It's titled Miracle in the Desert, The Rise and Fall of the Salton Sea. It's all about the Salton Sea, an accidental lake that was created by a mistake in Southern California between Palm Springs and the Imperial Valley. We're going to talk about the future of it, but first, before we get there, Greg, there was quite the heyday. You've already alluded to this, the enterprising folks who speculate there by building like a resort kind of community and even casinos, and Hollywood shows up there too, I understand.
Yeah, so in the 50s and 60s, the Salton Sea was hugely popular in Southern California. It was getting as many visitors, or in some cases more visitors a year than Yosemite National Park. So to give you a scale of how popular it was, I mean, it was hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, that would go to the Salton Sea, and they would go there for fishing, they would go there for, you know, water skiing, jet skiing, all these things. And ultimately, you know, when something becomes popular like that, land developers show up. And in the early 50s, they began to invest heavily in developing these communities along the shore of the Salton Sea. And these were not small communities. You can still go there and see them today, but they were building plans. They were selling land. Movie stars had started to come out. You know, the Rat Pack had come out there, with Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr. You had Marilyn Monroe. You had the Beach Boys. And it became sort of a glamorous place, probably for, the better part of 15 to 20 years. So it's kind of part of that unbelievable history that goes along with the Salton Sea, because if you were to, you know, go visit today, you wouldn't necessarily know that that happened. But it definitely, there was a huge heyday, and it was quite a vibrant place to go.
So this boomtown mentality, it takes a hit, I understand, in the 70s with some kind of a flood.
Yeah, so they built all this property, and they started marketing it, and they started, they called it a new Riviera in Southern California, and we show that in the film. They made these films, and they showed how wonderful it was to come here and to visit and to vacation, but ultimately, it didn't take off like they wanted it to. The land didn't sell. There was issues with the developments. It was very expensive to bring water and power, so by the 70s, those developments around the sea, which again are pretty extensive, had started to stagnate, and people just weren't coming back like they used to. And ultimately what happened was in the mid 70s, there was actually a hurricane that kind of the end of the hurricane sort of settled over Southern California and flooded the sea. It was Hurricane Kathleen. And what that kind of did was, it did two things. One is there was a lot of property destruction around the sea. The Salton Sea is very low. That's why water flowed in there initially. So all of this water flowed off of the mountains in the area and destroyed all these properties around the area. And so the people that were there kind of took off. The other thing that happened was it kind of filled up the sea, which is shallow. And so the sea level rose, and anything that was built along the shoreline kind of got flooded out. So it was a double whammy. You had people who had bought property there and paid good money for that property, have it be destroyed by these flash floods. Additionally, the people that had built along the shoreline, who thought that this shoreline was going to be stable, realized very quickly it was not. And so that property was destroyed as well. And so, you know, with no resorts, with the resorts being flooded and all this property damage, people just sort of stopped coming back to a certain extent. And that was kind of the first in a series of unfortunate incidents, which slowed down a lot of the traffic to the sea.
So if I jump ahead, way ahead, and we start talking about the dropping level there, I'm guessing that what that leaves all along the former shoreline is vacant, dilapidated structures. Is it kind of a ghost town around there in some places?
Yes, it is. And, you know, it's become iconic a little bit. People go out there to take photographs because it's almost like a huge ghost town around the area. What you see now, in certain spots, I don't want to paint it completely as, you know, this kind of everything's dilapidated. There's actually some areas which are quite beautiful still, and people live there, and it's these normal communities. But there are some areas where what's happened is, as people have left, some of the structures have been left behind. And now, having spoken to someone recently who has, you know, driven around it in the last 4 or 6 weeks, what's happening is as the shorelines are receding much more quickly, you're starting to actually see remnants from the 50s and the 40s emerge from the water. The reason is because back, I believe in this 80s, the sea level actually rose quite a bit. There was like a spike in the water that was coming into the sea, and it rose 13 feet. So it actually ended up covering up a lot of the stuff from the 50s. But now that it's going down, you're starting to see that stuff come back up again. So you're seeing electricity posts, you're seeing buildings that were framed out and are coming back out of the water. So it's kind of an eerie place because you're kind of seeing a society that collapsed a little bit and was covered up reemerge, you know?
In just a moment, I want to talk about some of the environmental considerations where this has become a huge, huge problem, not unlike a place also in California, Owens Lake, which the water was taken there, and I understand it dried up completely, and now you have the dust pollution and those dust storms. It's a fierce and dangerous situation. We're going to get there. I'm just curious, if I were to drop in at the Salton Sea today, is anybody fishing still?
No. So you won't see any boats, which is kind of one of the most eerie things, is you show up to this massive lake and there's nobody on the water. That's not a function of a lack of fish. There is still some fish in the sea, not as many as there used to be, but you can still probably find them. The reason you're going to find people fishing is as the shoreline recedes, all of the boat launches don't launch into the water anymore. They launch into, sand. So the big challenge actually with the sea and why people are not coming back is less about the water quality or that it's maybe a little eerie in the area. The big issue is access. As shorelines recede, you don't get access to the water because the boat launches don't go anywhere anymore. And if that shoreline continues to recede or even expand, nobody's going to build anything because you don't know where the water's going to be from one day to the next. So historically, that's actually been the big challenge with the sea that caused some of the issues, and why people left was because there's no stable shoreline. And when there's no stable shoreline, you can't build, you can't come back. Things are just totally inconsistent, and that drove people away as well.
Well, I've mentioned Owens Lake, and now let's talk dust. We've been talking about water so much, but as this area dries up, is there any forecast as to when the water's going to be gone? Have you talked to any hydrologists who can say, we have 5 years left, we have 10 years left, or something like that?
Well, there have been studies done on the impact of the dust, and I'll talk about that in a moment. As far as when is it going to dry up, there are projections. And the projections are this starts, it's already becoming a problem. So that's number one, is there's already dust being emitted from certain parts of the sea. When it's really going to start being a problem is likely in the next, within 5 to 7 years. That's my take on it. Nobody really knows. I think that's the challenge. But within the next 5 to 7 years, you're going to start to see a whole swath of the lake bed exposed. And then after that, it's going to rapidly accelerate. So within the next 5 to 15 years, you're going to start seeing some severe problems. The lake itself will not ever completely go away. It's never going to completely be nothing. There's always going to be a little bit of water coming off of the farms in the Imperial Valley, and there will always be a little bit of something there, but not much, So they're saying within the next 5 years, 5 to 7 years, you're going to see, I believe, 60 to 100,000 acres exposed. So that's kind of the projection right now. That being said, some of the people interviewed in the film who live in the area and go down there regularly, their observation is that whatever that they've predicted is too conservative, and that it's actually drying up much, much more quickly than, what the government projections are telling us.
Now, when you say there will always be a little bit of water there, if that is agricultural effluent off of farmland, I can't imagine that that's going to be desirable to be near. We're talking about excess nitrogen, and I don't know if they still put phosphorus on fields or phosphates or what have you. That's going to be a polluted little concentrated body of water.
Yeah, it'll be extremely concentrated, and right now, generally speaking, the water quality is still pretty decent because the sea is so large, and over time, with oxygenation and the wind, it tends to self kind of clear a little bit. But if it gets that tiny and that concentrated, it will be somewhat polluted. Now, that being said, we spoke to in the film, there's a Carrie Morrison. He runs one of the local organizations for rehabilitation and restoration of the sea. One thing that I learned is that even if it gets smaller, there's actually a positive side effect. Right now, it's a sort of in between. It's too salty for the fish, so a lot of the fish have unfortunately perished. But if it gets smaller and it gets hypersaline, what you will actually see happen is you'll see brine shrimp start to flourish, and these are small shrimp that love very, very hypersaline conditions. And in fact, that will cause some of the birds that left to come back. Right now, the birds aren't there because there's no food source. The fish are, generally speaking, they're gone. But if it becomes hypersaline and those brine shrimp come back, you'll actually see a larger bird population because they have something to eat. But for people, they will not be able to go in the water. The water will be too salty. It'll start to turn a red color, like you sort of see in the film. We examined some of the areas around the sea, and the water has turned red, and that's because it's just hypersaline. There's bacteria in there that thrive in that kind of water.
Well, you've just spoken about rehabilitation, restoration. It would be a massive undertaking to try to find water to what's the scope of the – or how serious are people about rehabilitation?
There's mixed feelings. You know, the film is very much about finding a solution. I would say, obviously, the people in the area want rehabilitation because and restoration because if it dries up and it turns into an Owens Lake, what will happen is you will start to have huge amounts of dust blown off of this dry salt flat effectively, and that will cause air pollution issues. You'll have particulate matter. That area already is very prone and has high rates of asthma because of the dust and the wind that's already there. And you can potentially affect Southern California at large by having this particulate. So the people in the area want a solution. I think the challenge is that the government and the state of California obviously has many issues it has to deal with all the time. And there was a solution in place in 2008 and 2009 that was going to be $9 billion to restore and or mitigate the sea. Unfortunately, due to the financial crisis at the time, that went away. And so what's going on now is there is a 10-year plan that has been approved by the state of California, but it seems that it's far behind already, 2 years in, and that the overall money that was appropriated for it, you know, I think they initially said we're going to give $200 to $300 million, which sounds like a lot, but for a lake that large is pretty small. They've only allocated, I think, maybe 10% of that, 20% of that. They have not given the full amount because they are giving it in stages based on how effective the projects are that are being executed. And those projects are far behind and the money's not being released.
What would the money actually buy? I mean, it's nice to go buy water, but where would it even come from?
Well, it's not to buy water, actually. The state's view is that there's not enough fresh water because you're going to need fresh water. You can't put more salty water in a salty lake. The state's view is effectively you're not going to have the sea the way it was before. That's not going to happen. So you have to cover up the areas that might emit dust. So that's what the 10-year plan is for, is not for bringing in more water. It's for dust mitigation. It's to effectively flood those dry areas with shallow water, which is what they've done to a certain extent up at Owens Lake in Northern California. But that was a huge disaster, and it took 15, 20 years and $2 to $3 billion just to cover up those emissive areas. And that's what they're trying to do with the Salton Sea, but they're very far behind. And the Salton Sea is 4 to 5 times larger than Owens Lake. So whatever Owens Lake was in terms of a disaster, this is magnitudes larger. And in terms of bringing water, the option that is explored in the film is effectively building a canal to the Sea of Cortez, which is about 25 miles away from the sea, and doing some desalinization and bringing that water in.
Yeah, the Sea of Cortez. That's that. I grew up calling that the Gulf of California.
Yes. Yes.
It's the ocean. You'd be bringing in. You have to get the salt out.
You would have to get the salt out. Now, the organizations in the area, what their attitude is. Well, look, Southern California has a shortage of water to begin with, and the Colorado River doesn't have much water left to give. It's been tapped from top to bottom, right? So if you build a canal to the Sea of Cortez, A, you can run the water using gravity into the Salton Sea because that's, you know, the way that it's 250 feet below sea level roughly. Second is you could potentially start desalinization, which some people argue we're going to need to do anyway to continue to have the water that we want and we need. So it serves a dual purpose. It's a huge, ambitious project. And, you know, whether or not it's feasible is debatable because you have to negotiate with Mexico and you have to negotiate with California. And the state is not particularly open to that plan, so far as I know. But that's kind of the scale and the scope of what you need to if you wanted to bring the sea back to what it was. That is not what the state is sort of trying to do at this point. They just want to mitigate the problems.
Well, Greg, you're a film producer and you've made a documentary, and here we are having a conversation. And for this whole conversation, you have really presented facts and history, and you've woven the narrative for us. You've painted a picture. I'm just wondering about where you are now emotionally about all of this. You can't devote your, you know, 5 years of your life to doing this kind of a thing. Do you feel emotionally at any kind of level exhausted by what you've learned? Do you ever cry about what's happened? Do you think about, do you have a positive outlook for the future? How has this changed you?
I do have a positive outlook. I didn't know about it, and you become, you know, it's a beautiful place. It's actually very beautiful. It's very peaceful. It's very unique. It's not this kind of cesspool or anything that people kind of have built up in their minds. And it's a wonderful place to go. It's a wonderful place to see. And I hope that some of these initiatives work. In my heart of hearts, if somehow they could bring it back, I think that would be extraordinary. Not simply for us. I think unfortunately, we have a human first view of the world. You know, there's millions of animals that depend on that sea. And as it goes away, their home goes away. So for the sake of them, you would hope that it stabilizes or maybe comes back or some such thing. Because at one point there was 1 million birds at a time, at one time, that would you know, sit on the sea and eat. And it was a huge stopping place. So I'm hopeful. I think there are positive changes that will happen. I do think about it. You know, you can't spend that long, you know, a chunk of your life on something and not think about it. And I will go back there and just to visit. And I still have friends in the area. So I think there's positive things that can happen. I just hope that there's awareness, larger awareness that's raised for what's going on and how it can affect people in Southern California.
Well, it seems the easiest place for people to follow up on this story is to go to the website miracleinthedesert.com, and you can hook up there to see the documentary too as well. Greg, what a story, and you've been very helpful to us here on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me, and thank you for taking the time and letting me sort of spread the word. I really appreciate it.
Once again, the title is Miracle in the Desert, The Rise and Fall of the Salton Sea. We've been visiting with the director of that documentary, Greg Bassenian. So there you have it, the Salton Sea, the largest lake in California, an accident of modern engineering. And you might be able to say the same about the state's largest city just over the hills to the northwest. How Los Angeles blossomed in the desert. Maybe not an accident exactly, but an invention, perhaps? When Constant Wonder returns after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. The Salton Sea was an accident, but that nearby megalopolis we call Los Angeles, that was an invention because it was built against all odds. With no water there, there shouldn't be people. So it took innovation, creativity, and actually a little deception to persuade people to come and make the place thrive. How did one of the most glamorous and expensive real estate markets explode in population out of just a dry cow town? Gary Crist is author of The Mirage Factory, Illusion, Imagination, and the Invention of Los Angeles.
There's no reason why a big city should grow in Southern California. Not to insult you and San Diego either, but you know, you pointed out that the water is a huge problem. And in LA, there wasn't a lot of coal. There weren't big forests that would support heavy industry. It didn't have a good port, which San Diego does. And it was just very far from separated from everything by desert and mountain ranges. And so there was no logical reason for a city to grow up here. So to pull off that trick, it required a good deal of imagination, a lot of out-of-the-box thinking, and a good bit of deceptive advertising at times. And I wanted to examine the major forces that enabled this city to grow up where no city, you know, logically should be. And I isolated three of them and three people who could serve as sort of avatars. I'm not saying that these three people individually created Los Angeles or anything like that, but they're avatars for the forces that did create Los Angeles. They are William Mulholland, the water czar for many decades in Los Angeles, D.W. Griffith, the father, so-called father of film, a great early film director, and an evangelist named Amy Semple McPherson, whom some people might find an unusual choice, but I'll explain exactly why I chose her. The big problem was water. It was the first problem that had to be solved. There wasn't enough water locally for anything larger than 100, maybe 150,000 person city. So William Mulholland, this totally self-taught engineer, a very gruff Irish immigrant, came to LA at a very early stage and basically identified himself with the whole water issue that the city had to solve. And he came up with this idea to transport water that was abundant 250 miles away and bring that water, essentially change the whole geography of Southern California to bring that water to LA. And so he built this magnificent aqueduct. And when everybody said he was crazy, you know, there's no way that you can do this, but he managed to do it. And that alone made a much larger city possible.
Yeah, you know, the engineering behind this is something I couldn't possibly wrap my head around. It just seems amazing that somebody was going after it at an early part of the 20th century. Are we talking 20th century here?
Yeah. He started building in the early teens, but he got the idea a lot earlier. At the time, you know, the only bigger project was the Panama Canal project that was going on. This was just, and that was supported by an entire federal government. This was a city that wanted to do this. So everybody said he was crazy, but of course he did it. And that's one of the things about these mirages that I talk about. They eventually do become real. And these, you know, I call them flawed visionaries. These are the people who made these mirages real.
Yeah,
and anyway, the second, you know, big problem was that there wasn't enough industry to support a major city. So more or less what happened is they made up their own industry. They created a brand new industry, the motion picture industry, which doesn't require a lot of coal or forests or things like that. And one of the key figures here was D.W. Griffith. Now, he would later claim that he invented a lot of basic film techniques like close-ups and cross-cutting. He didn't really do that. These ideas were in the air when he was just starting. But he really combined them into a kind of grammar of visual storytelling that really, really worked. And all the other directors were basically copying D.W. Griffith when he came to L.A. in the early teens. And then it was his movie, as problematic as it is in so many ways, his epic, The Birth of a Nation, which really finally made movies an industry. That the movie did so unbelievably well, you know, several times better than any other previous movie, that suddenly Wall Street was saying, this is not just a cottage industry, this is a big business. So it more or less invented movie making as an industry. This one film, which is horribly racist, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a hard movie to watch right now, but it was amazingly popular in its day. So, you know, we have the water now, we have an industry that can support a city. But cities also need a kind of identity, a kind of ethos. And LA established early on an ethos of a kind of center for unorthodox spirituality and unconventional lifestyles. It's centered around healing and religion. And one of the people most responsible for this is a woman named Amy Semple McPherson. Now, in this day and age, a lot of people haven't heard of her. But in the 20s, for instance, she was probably much better known than either of these other two guys. She was a Pentecostalist preacher faith healer. She traveled around the country doing revivals, and finally she got a message from God, she said, that said, go to Los Angeles and make that a center for me. And so she came to Los Angeles in 1918, and she proceeded to become so popular that she was able to build a temple, the Angelus Temple, which still stands in LA today. She founded her own religion, the Four Square religion, which is still, it's got millions of adherents worldwide. And she became a kind of tourist attraction in LA that people would come from all over the country to go to the Angelus Temple and see Sister Amy, or Sister as she was called, preach. And she would do these illustrated sermons where things would be acted out. And she was learning a lot of techniques from Hollywood just down the road, as a matter of fact. She just really drew a lot of attention to LA as this spiritual center. So I maintain that these three people, while they single-handedly didn't make the city possible, they kind of represent the forces that did make it possible.
I do want to go back to these three individuals in the course of our conversation, but as long as you're talking about Amy Semple McPherson right now, I find it fascinating that this happened before television. So she couldn't have been a televangelist, but I think she's the equivalent of a modern day megachurch televangelist type person. Is that kind of a good characterization?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And she was one of the earliest radio preachers. People would listen to her radio broadcasts. She started her own radio station. And, you know, it can be argued that the Angelus Temple was kind of the first megachurch in the country. I mean, that's a little bit debatable, but you can at least argue it. So, yeah, she was very much at the forefront of that kind of movement.
So, in a way, you're telling not really biographies of these people. They're certainly portraits in a way, but the real biography is you're telling the story, the life story of how Los Angeles came to be, how it was possible, how the phenomenon of urban development was even feasible in those days. I wonder if the kind of hindsight that we have today gets in the way of us understanding how preposterous it was for a city to be built here. With that visionary outlook, do you think these people were seen as crazy at some level?
Oh, yeah. A lot of them were you know, particularly Amy Semple McPherson. But D.W. Griffith, he had a very tough time late in life because he held on to these Victorian notions of storytelling that may have worked in the teens, but in the 20s, when people were more sophisticated, they started to think that, you know, he was old hat. And you know, William Mulholland, they all three of these people really had a comeuppance. They all kind of self-destructed in the late 1920s in a way that kind of ruined them, at least for a time. You know, William Mulholland built this dam, the St. Francis Dam, which failed catastrophically in the late 20s and set off a huge flood that ended up killing over 500 people, and it basically ruined his long career. People blamed him for this, and it was kind of his fault. he built the dam, and basically he was never the same after that, and he quickly retired and died kind of a broken man. D.W. Griffith, as I said, he had a much slower demise. He just couldn't get anybody to hire him. He was considered old Hollywood. We're new Hollywood now. And so he ended up, there are horrible scenes of him in the Knickerbocker Hotel in the 30s, totally drunk and just, you know, hoping that somebody will hire him for something. And Amy Semple McPherson had a very strange story. I believe she faked her kidnapping. It's still not clear whether she was really kidnapped or not. I kind of have my doubts that she was. She went to the beach one day with her secretary in 1926, and her secretary went to get some popcorn or something, came back, and she was missing for weeks. And then you know, this set off this like media frenzy. It was one of the earliest, you know, it was like the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And everybody was wondering what happened to Amy, what happened to Amy. And she stumbles into a little town in Mexico one day with this really kind of preposterous tale of being kidnapped. And when her kidnappers were out of the room, she was able to cut her her ropes with a tin can, and she jumped out the window and trekked across the desert all night. And well, she, a lot of her followers believed her, but official LA did not believe her, and they ended up taking her to court for fraud. And it didn't. Eventually, they dropped the case amid rumors that she had paid off the DA, but it really hurt her reputation. She became kind of a joke for a while, and so she had her downfall. But she kind of redeemed herself later in life because she lived on into the 40s. And during the Depression and during World War II, she fed a lot of people during the Depression. And World War II, she was selling Liberty bonds and things like that. So she really kind of came back from that. But it's interesting that all of these flawed visionaries did have their somewhat dramatic comeuppances.
Illusion, imagination, and the invention of Los Angeles. Gary, those I words, illusion, imagination, invention, they all have to do in their senses with sort of, well, those words subvert the idea that you're standing on terra firma. It's all imaginary, it's all pretend, it could be fake. And yet a city comes out of it. And if I'm thinking of a city that emerges from the fabrication of stories, Los Angeles kind of fits, doesn't it?
It does. I always tell people that the mirage that I talk about is a double-edged sword. Yeah, mirages are not real until they become real. You know, the interesting thing about Los Angeles, its history has been all about telling stories and creating images. You know, movie making itself is creating fake images. They were selling the city as a blossoming garden in the desert long before there was enough water to support that. But eventually, they, through imagination, they were able to make these things real. So there is still that sense of unreality about LA. But these days, in particular, there's a lot behind it now. It may start out as illusion and unreality, but due to a lot of innovation, and I think LA is a center for innovation. A lot of really forward thinking is coming out of LA these days, and I think it's because they had this legacy. I almost think that it was a case of necessity being the mother of invention. You know, they did. You know, San Francisco, for instance, had a magnificent port, and you know, it had gold in the hills to the west, to the east of town. So you know, they didn't have to do anything to make their city grow. Los Angeles had these problems that had to be solved, and so I think that has created a legacy of creative thinking that persists to this day.
This whole time I'm thinking about Meredith Wilson and the Music Man. You know, I'm thinking about somebody who comes to town and wants to sell you a bill of goods.
Really?
Do you push this to the degree where in some ways you're wondering about how above board is it to be telling people, come to Los Angeles, we're making some, this is going to be a happening place. It's, I mean, there's a bridge I can sell you in Brooklyn too. I mean, it's shady. Right. How shady is it?
Well, you know, there was a lot of deception going on. They would sell lots in alleged neighborhoods, and people would show up and realize that there weren't roads, there weren't anything. There were just basically lots in the desert. But eventually, the neighborhoods were built. And you know, for instance, to get the aqueduct done, they had to really deceive the farmers in this valley where they were going to take the water. They were turning over their water rights to what they thought was a representative of the U.S. government who was going to do some wonderful project for the local farmers. And it turned out that they were selling them to the city of Los Angeles to take the water away from their valley and use it 250 miles away. So it's, you know, there is a lot of kind of shadiness to this. There are definitely deep shadows along with the brilliant lights.
Talk to us, if you would, about idealism in this. Obviously, that has to be part of this. It's an ambitious proposition to build a city where one should not be because there's not the natural resource to support it. There's no logical topography or geography that says this is a good place to have a city. But the idealism, this is happening in an age, we're talking leading up to the Great Depression. So this is before the Great Depression. I guess there was a sense of boosterism going on. And I'm wondering if it was seen as kind of a second gold rush.
To a certain extent, yes. This was an age where people believed that technology can do anything. You know, humankind can do anything if we just work at it. And, you know, they created this artificial environment without thinking, is this sustainable? And that's kind of the price we're paying now for that kind of idealism where, you know, anything the human mind can imagine can be made real. But yes, there are prices to pay. And now, you know, water continues to be a difficult problem. The whole car culture of Los Angeles has become a major nightmare.
Now, let's go back to the idea that you've taken three characters, three people who are not maybe of seminal importance, but certainly are representative of what happened in the growth of this city at its birth. And you tell these stories, three people who were kind of comets that flame out or mostly flame out. I'm wondering to what extent that trajectory, that story applies to the city itself. And I guess I'm inviting you into some prognostication. I mean, is LA, has it risked flaming out if it's in a precarious position with little resource?
Well, you know, there is that danger, you know, particularly with climate change and things like that. Will Los Angeles be a sustainable endeavor? It's hard to say, and I'd say the jury is still out. But I would argue that, you know, the same kind of innovation and imagination that made the city possible in the first place will come to the fore again and enable it to sustain itself into the future.
Gary Crist, author of The Mirage Factory: Illusion, Imagination, and the Invention of Los Angeles.
Marcus Smith there. You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzka. Artificial intelligence was long consigned to the fringes of scientific aspiration. Then two researchers came along with other ideas. One, a 64-year-old computer science professor with back problems so severe he couldn't fly or drive. The other, a 36-year-old neuroscientist and chess prodigy. Two men, two paths, one vision that today is worth billions of dollars.